Stephanie.
Ms. O'Connor.
Yes, may it please the court, Joanne O'Connor on behalf of the estate of Richard Spizzieri, John J. McAtee Jr., its personal representative. The issue before you this morning is whether Mr. Spizzieri's estate was entitled to take as a deduction under Section 2053 of the Internal Revenue Code three $1 million payments that the decedent contracted to pay to the adult children of his estranged wife, Holly Luders. Those children later had to file claims against the estate in order to enforce them. Section 2053C1A of the Internal Revenue Code allows these deductions against the estate for claims that are contracted for bona fide and for full and adequate consideration. The policy here is to prevent tax avoidance, yep, to allow contractual claims but disallow what are simply disguised bequests to the natural objects of one's bounty. As this court recognized in...
These weren't so disguised. I mean, the agreement said it was done, we want you to put this in the will. In other words, we wouldn't even be here if the decedent had actually complied with his obligations under the antenuptial agreement. He would have amended the will, they would have taken by the will, and there would have been no need for this. And so you're right that these factors are used to sort of look to see whether a contract is a way around it, but I don't know that we have to get too far for the bona fide. Am I missing something?
Yes, Your Honor. We suggest that, as the Huntington Court said, it did not decide whether an original promise to put a bequest in a will could never turn into a claim, and we think the facts here are very unique.
Well, I wouldn't say never. I think that's not wrong. But again, if the purpose is as you said, and I think you explained the law exactly right, is to distinguish whether it's donative or instead a bona fide contract.
Sure.
Isn't the fact that this was done with a promise to put it in the will to give up the spousal share of the estate part of donative intent?
Well, I think that promise rings relatively hollow when you have Mr. Spizzieri was a corporate attorney at Davis Polk & Wardwell. He certainly knew how to provide for his beneficiaries in his will. Certainly, he had done his original will back in 1979. But by the time of this third modification in 2005, there was evidence that these spouses were estranged. This third modification was ratified in 2006 and again in 2009. Certainly, we know that shortly, contemporaneously with 2009, the commission stipulated that Mr. Spizzieri had two out-of-wedlock children by at least 2010 or 2011, one of them during a time that he was living separately from Ms. Luders. But notably, even though 10 years passed between the time of the third modification in 2005 and Mr. Spizzieri's 2015 death, he created codicils for his other biological children. And in those codicils, he expressly said, you're not going to be provided for in my estate and in under my will, but nevertheless, I'm providing for you by these codicils. And we'd submit that evidence is he knew to the extent he needed to amend his will to provide for the Luder's stepchildren, and he didn't do it. It was
why he did or didn't is beyond me. A lot of what the decedent did is beyond me. He appeared to live an interesting lifestyle, to say the least. But let's get past the will part, and let's go through the factors that the Treasury regulations tell us to look at.
Yes.
And I'm looking at 20.2053-1, B. And so the factors, when you're dealing with a family member, and I think here it's a lineal, since it's a lineal descendant of a spouse, it's a close family member, we look through the factors that are given there. And the first one is that the transaction occurred in the regular course, is negotiated at arm's length, and is free of donative intent. Here, I know you guys fight over the arm's length, and let's say I give you that.
Yeah.
This is not an antenuptial agreement is not done in the ordinary course of business. This is not this is not like, hey, I'm hiring a landlord to take care of my apartment, you know, for the 6 months before the estate is processed. This is not an ordinary business transaction, is it?
Your Honor, when you get to the time of the third modification in 2005, we'd submit certainly it is. This record, the Huntington case recognized hard bargaining between hostile parties is not a requirement when you're talking about arm's
length. That's for arm's length. I'm not talking about arm's length. You're required to show, or one of the factors we look at is ordinary course of business. And the purpose is to show, is this just sort of business transaction between parties, or was this sort of a one-time sort of thing? And it seemed to me that especially the payments to the children were just one time. It was in the third modification. That's sort of it. How is that ordinary course of business?
Well, Your Honor, I'd submit that it was clearly transactional, as you noted. And I mean, that's an ordinary course of business in terms of the situation they were in at the time where she's agreeing to ratify and confirm her waiver of support right.
Are you saying it's some sort of subjective ordinary course of business standard? I don't know that ordinary usually makes me think, well, we look at what this particular person usually did because of his incredibly odd family circumstances. Do we look at what he usually would have done or what an ordinary person would have usually done?
Well, I mean, I think clearly when we're talking about these in terms of deductions against the estate and the courts are routinely addressing these in the context of prenuptial agreements like the one we're at issue here, I think ordinary course of business refers to the particular circumstances. And
here's even an antecedent question, which is, are we looking at the tax court's finding that this agreement was not contracted bona fide for clear error? Are you saying we look at it under a different standard than that?
You do look at it for clear error. I would submit that the tax court's decision not to shift the burden to the commission is arguably a mixed question of law and fact that should be reviewed de novo. But the underlying facts and whether the factors of 2053 were satisfied, sure, absolutely is for clear error.
All right, I want to look at the second factor because we're getting run out of time. The next one is whether the nature of the claim is not related to an expectation or claim of inheritance. So just as relatedness, I know there's some consideration that you guys fight about, but again, given that the statement was, I'm going to put you in the will in exchange for this other stuff, how can we say that it's not related to an expectation of inheritance?
Because these children were never the natural objects of Mr. Luder's bounty. They were related only by marriage. They weren't beneficiaries under his estate or will, even though he said he would put them in the will.
Yeah, but they expected it to be. They knew it. I mean, the whole family knew it. That was the whole point. I'm going to put you in the will in exchange for my mom doing this other stuff.
Well, I don't think there's any evidence that they knew it. I think the evidence is that in 2014 and 2015...
Wasn't the evidence that they filed a claim? I mean, they knew they were entitled to the money.
They filed a claim against the estate.
Based on the third modification.
But they never claimed a right to inherit under the will.
Right, they couldn't because they're not in the will.
Right.
But the point is, they certainly knew the third modification said we're going to get $1 million in the will. That's why they filed the claim. Right?
I don't know why they filed the claim. I don't think there's...
All right, let's go to the next factor. The next factor is that the claim originates pursuant to an agreement between the decedent and the family member. Here, the agreement is not between the decedent and the family member that's seeking the claim. It's between the decedent and someone outside of the family member that's seeking the claim. The family member who entered into the agreement is the mom. It's the kids seeking it. So it's not even a contract between the kids and the decedent, right?
I submit that they are third-party beneficiaries of this agreement, and just as the court looked
doesn't
at it in Costco.
Doesn't that seem clear that that's donative? I mean, that's the whole point, is someone is benefiting from this agreement. That's the whole concept of the will, that there's third parties that are benefiting from my demise.
Right, but the decedent would need to have a donative intent toward these individual stepchildren.
And then the next one deals with performance pursuant to an agreement between just the family member and the decedent that has the same issue. But the last one goes to amounts paid in satisfaction are reported by each party for federal income and employment taxes. Now, I know the estate reported it, but there, at least as I understand it, there's no evidence in the record that was presented by your clients that they listed this as part of their income or filed the appropriate forms, right?
No, that is not correct. There's evidence in the record that the estate issued Form 1099s reflecting these payments.
But I agree with that. But that's the estate side of it. It's that the factor says that each party reported it. There's no evidence that your clients reported it on there. So when 1099 is issued, you need another side to then put it on their income tax.
Do you mean, when you say your clients, you mean the looter's stepchildren?
That's right.
Yes. And our position is that's information that was uniquely within the purview of the commission.
No, it's not. It's not uniquely. The kids had to come and just testify that I put this in my tax return or submitted their tax returns or submitted an affidavit saying they did it.
And the kids were adverse claimants at the time. And on that issue,
You could subpoena that. I mean, that's certainly subpoenaable. You could depose them.
We shifted the burden to the commission, and that they easily could have come in and offered that evidence. And it's also on the failure to, on the issuance of the forms 1099,
the burden if you had credible evidence that you were entitled to the deduction. And speaking for myself, I don't see how you shifted the burden.
I'll reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Okay. Let's hear from the counsel for the government.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Pooja Boysher on behalf of the Commissioner of Internal Revenue. Judge Luck, you are absolutely right. Each of the factors in 20.2053-1 resolves this case in favor of the commissioner.
If we just decide this on the bona fide issue, we don't need to reach the consideration.
That's absolutely right.
Because you need both.
That's absolutely right, Your Honor.
All right. I have to say, though, and I do want to talk a little bit about the consideration issue. I'm not 100% convinced on the consideration issue.
Sure. I'm happy to go there first.
So they offer a couple different arguments. One that seems persuasive to me is we don't read contracts article by article. We read contracts as a whole, and that's just not me saying it. That's New York law, which is how we're bound to apply this contract. And here, if you look at the recitals, it seems to suggest that the entire package was done as a way to resolve all marital and estate issues. I mean, that's the way the recitals are written. I'm paraphrasing. I can read it to you, but that's essentially what they're doing. I just have a hard time seeing that these are completely independent agreements that happen to be in one agreement as part of a whole that's then modified five different times for different bargains going back and forth. And to say that these are completely independent and we look at it that way. How do you, yet the tax court seemed to suggest that we should do that. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor, for a couple of reasons. The first is, as taxpayer just acknowledged, these were sophisticated entities. Mr. Spazieri was a very sophisticated attorney. And they not only labeled the sections in the prenup for which type of waivers Ms. Luters would be waiving to receive certain types of benefits, right? If she waived her right to the marital estate upon Mr. Spazieri's death, she got 25% of his gross estate and an East Hampton five years in his East Hampton property. If he and Ms. Luters divorced, she got a separate set of rights. The paragraphs say that. But the most important agreement that this court is going to look at is the third modification. There is nothing in the third modification relating to Ms. Luters' waiver of her.
I don't disagree, but it's hard. You can't look at the modification. The way the modifications are written is this modifies one particular part of the agreement, but we incorporate everything other than that's not inconsistent with the agreement. I mean, so you have to read it as a whole. You can't just read that thing in isolation, can you?
No, you can't read it in isolation, but if you're reading it as a whole, you're taking note of each time they say, we're waiving this for this. And that waiver of marital rights in the estate is very specific as to what she gets. And the third modification specifically says she gets the payments to her children in the event of Mr. Spazieri's death. It is very clear on the third modification.
What do we do with the recitals, though, which are part of the modifications also? I mean, the recitals say, I'll quote, they have agreed to fix their rights and obligations to their property and to support of one another in the event of their separation or the legal termination of marriage, and to fix their rights and obligations and their property upon death. That's the recital for the whole thing.
Sure.
And so if you're right that certainly there's an article as to marriage and an article as to death and an article as to this, an article as to spousal support and alimony, and I understand all of that, but and I get that there's different arrangements for each, but it's hard for me to be able to say that you can pull one string out and it's completely independent of the other string where they're telling you that this was done to fix our rights and obligations in all cases.
Yeah, this case, the prenup in this case is very different, for example, than the prenup involved in Pollard, the tax court case, where the court says, this is a simple agreement. It's two paragraphs. Yes, there's a waiver of one right in the first and waiver in the second. But when you're looking at a very simple agreement like that, we can say that there's an overall exchange. And that is not the case that
okay,
we have.
Okay, so let's assume we get past that.
Sure.
And let's assume we just look at the third modification. What they say is, and there's evidence that seems to suggest this, that Ms. Luders gave up a valuable right in order to get this. And I know what the agreement says. I know it says it's done in lieu of this or that. I understand what the language says.
Yeah.
But how can we say that's not consideration where you are giving up a valuable right to 25% interest in a trust in the estate property versus a lump sum payment that seems to be less than the value it would have been if it was 25% of the total estate?
Your Honor, in the tax court, taxpayer has never argued, and they cannot argue, that Ms. Luders, both in the prenup and in the third modification, was waiving the same exact right. That was her right to the marital estate. And because she was relinquishing that same exact right, the benefit that the estate got was also the same.
I don't think
same.
That's the argument. I think the argument is that in the third modification, she gave up the 25% interest in a trust that would have been created and the off-putting of that, or the proceeds of that, and instead got a lump sum for her and then a lump sum for her children. And that, in total, was actually worth less than she had given up. That, in other words, I entered the modification to give up these things in order to get this benefit for my kids.
Okay.
How's that not reflected in the agreement?
Yeah, so two responses. The first is, at all times, like I said, that she was always waiving her marital rights. And this court, not specifically, but other courts that have analyzed this issue, it says a decedent's... the worth that a decedent gets for testamentary freedom. So now Mr. Spazieri has more money to either invest, is what they argue below, or to give to his actual children. That is testamentary freedom. That in and of itself has no value in money or money's worth, which is what that consideration prong looks at. Because it's not a fungible thing. He cannot sell his testamentary freedom to someone else.
Are you talking about the Second Circuit's Herman case?
The Herman said that, but there's another case that's
Herman
really
deals with Herman deals with a different thing. It deals with marital,
as I understand it.
It deals with marital property.
That's right. No, that's this not, is not from the Herman case, but yes. But you're right. We can go to Herman if you want.
I think you're probably right on Herman. I think Herman is right, at least as to that. But I think, and that goes to their argument about, well, they did waive the marital property. But putting that aside, giving up an interest in the estate, because that's not contingent. He's going to die. There is a certainty of death. There isn't a certainty of divorce, but there is a certainty of death.
Yeah.
And so that is not nearly as contingent. And she's giving up a significant right for what seems to be a lesser worth benefit in order to benefit her children.
What seems with that, what you just said, Judge, what seems is exactly right. They had the burden of demonstrating that the value of what you relinquished in the third modification was less than what you relinquished in the first.
Didn't they present expert testimony on that point?
They did present expert testimony. The expert did not show that those values were actually different. And it wouldn't have been, right? As they acknowledged, she had a premier boutique law firm representing her in these negotiations. Why would her attorneys let her get less in exchange for more to Mr. Spazieri, right? So there was no evidence that they did that below, and the tax court therefore didn't rely on that element.
So we don't have to get to any of this, right, if there's not payments contracted bona fide, right?
That is right, Your Honor.
And it seems like all the factors on that point in favor of the service.
That's right, Your Honor.
Can you talk a bit about that? Because if that's true, then that's what your opposing counsel talked about in her entire presentation.
Yeah.
Can we talk about that?
Yeah, sure. So 20.2053(1)(b)(2) is extremely helpful, as Judge Luck went factor by factor. It also has an extremely helpful example of what it means when it says an agreement among family members is contracted bona fide in consideration. And that example was when, say, a niece of the decedent has done accounting work for her uncle. That is in the ordinary course of business. It is negotiated at arm's length. It does not involve any sort of expectation of inheritance. And so all of those factors are an example of when that is contracted bona fide. In this case, we have stepchildren of Mr. Spazieri who are now filing claims. Like you said, Judge Luck, they did have an expectation of inheritance. in the original prenup and in the third modification, Mr. Spazieri said, I'm going to make these payments to you and I'm going to put it in my will. If that is not an example of an expectation of inheritance, I do not know what is. And the other factor to consider here is that I know that Ms. Counsel on the other side would like to say that he was not showing any sort of donative in nature towards his stepchildren. That's not true. The facts show otherwise. Up until the year he died, he was making payments to one of Miss Luter's daughters, Venetia Luter's.
Yeah, 25,700 in 2014, 21,000 in 2015, right?
That's right, Your Honor. And they lost on that issue, whether or not that was a gift below, and they have not appealed that issue.
What's your response to the argument that the ordinary course of business can be defined by the fact that he was constantly doing codicils and negotiating with his wife over various things?
Yeah, so the way I have tried to visualize this, Your Honor, and that has helped me, is are the parties sitting on the same side, and the parties here being Ms. Luter's and Mr. Spazieri, or are they on the same side of the table or on the opposite sides of the table? Both at the time of the original prenup and the third modification, they were still married. They had not legally separated. They were talking about their plans for their families. So in that regard, he was not operating at arm's length with her. I know that the example of him making codicils for his children was something that the other side raised, but that doesn't indicate to me that he and Ms. Luter's were ever also not negotiating.
But that gets to the arm's length issue. Judge Grant, I never do that, I'm sorry. Judge Grant asked you about the ordinary course of business.
Yeah, this is not an ordinary course of business. This is not like the hypothetical of the niece doing accounting services.
No, but what your opposing counsel said was that in their relationship, this was ordinary. In other words, in the world, it's not ordinary. I mean, you know, this was a very not ordinary marriage. But in their course of dealing, they seemed to have regular modifications for at least 10 years that they were married and sort of lived separately and had this sort of interesting arrangement between them. Why, at least in this context, is it not ordinary, even if in the larger scope of the world, it's not necessarily an ordinary
one? Yeah, I think the larger scope of the world applies here, too. It's not ordinary for a couple who is still married, who remains married up and through the decedent's death. I mean, they were spouses, that they would then be considered parties on the opposite.
Would we even have to decide that, though, if there was donative intent?
No, right, because that's
it's
exactly
conjunctive,
what these factors
right? You got to prove all those, and if there's donative intent, we don't even have to worry about that, right?
That's right, Your Honor. Yeah. If there are no further questions, the government asks that this court affirm. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. O'Connor, you've got 5 minutes.
Thank you, and just briefly to pick up to pick up on the ordinary course of business and this idea that something that stems out of a prenup could not otherwise be in the ordinary course of business, I think you need to even look at the estate of Carley, where a deduction was upheld. And the estate of Carley, the wife was waiving her community interest in the decedent's earnings, and the court there held that that was valuable consideration. So to the extent we're going to say that there needs to be some kind of a contract outside of the marital relationship, outside of a prenup, I don't think that's supported by the case law that actually finds deductions under Section 2053. On Chief Judge Pryor's question about the checks to one of the decedent stepchildren, I'd note that those checks in 2014 and 2015, they were isolated. They were for much lower amounts. They were outside of a contract. There was no negotiation at all. That is the example of donative intent, where you're simply gifting someone. You're not in the midst of negotiations over 5 modifications with highly experienced counsel representing both sides. And notably, at the same time those checks were being issued, again, I think one of
these
them...
Were these monthly checks?
They weren't. They were sporadic over the course of 2014 and 2015.
It wasn't a lump sum each year, though.
Correct. They ranged, I believe, from $1,500 to
$3,400. They continued up to the month before his death?
Continued, yes, I believe so, sir. But 3 days after one of these checks was issued to Ms. Young, he entered into the second and third codicil to provide for one of his out-of-wedlock children. Again, clearly on his mind would have been providing for at least his biological children, and he expressly never took any steps to fulfill that promise to put the Luter's stepchildren in his will. on consideration.
What are you, yeah. I'm not sure what you're saying we should take from that assertion.
That the promise to put the Luter stepchildren in his will rings hollow, doesn't evidence donative intent, where he never carried through on that at all. He had the opportunity to for 10 years. He certainly did it for his biological children.
He contracted to do it, but he didn't mean it in his heart. So we should assume that it wasn't donative intent.
Well, he didn't contract to do it. I mean,
I thought you were saying that it was a bona fide contract.
The third modification was absolutely a bona fide contract, but it wasn't sufficient. His promise to put the Luter stepchildren in his will certainly wasn't sufficient for them to then claim against the will.
Okay.
They were making claims pursuant to this contractual obligation in the third modification. And on the consideration, certainly there's a real unique situation here where prior to the third modification, leading up from the prenup in 1997 all the way to 2005, Ms. Luters had very valuable rights under that third modification. The lifetime income stream from a trust supported by 25% of his gross estate, which we know had ballooned from $28 million in 1997 to nearly $82 million at the time of his death. And it is correct that the expert just valued the minimum distribution of $200,000 a year plus cost of living adjustment from that income stream, but it's reasonable and common sense to understand that that professionally administrated trust would have been spinning off close to $1 million a year if you had, at the time of his death, $20 million in a trust, even at 5%. That's $1 million to her per year for the rest of her life. She was 56 years old at the time of the third modification. She had a 20 to 30 year life expectancy. And Ms. Justice Sachs testified to the value in the decedent to buy off these complex obligations that would run over the life of Ms. Luters and tie up the estate for a man that was an active investor, used his highly leveraged assets to do that, and free the estate and ensure that his residuary estate would go to his heirs, his biological children, under his will at death or soon thereafter. And with that, I'd rest. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. O'Connor. We have your case. We'll move to the last one for today.